I realised it was a stupid thing to say. I'd said it because I couldn't bear the idea of him being unhappy. I'd said it because I wanted it to be true. "I'll be fine," he said quietly. I felt as if I'd failed him. I wondered how long he'd wanted to tell me that. We lay there for a while. I ran a finger lightly along his arm, trying to work out what to say.
"You?"
he murmured.
"Me what?"
"Tell me something I don't know. About you." I was going to tell him he knew all the important stuff. I was going to be my New York self, full of life, go-getting, impenetrable. I was going to say something to make him laugh. But he had told me his truth. I turned so that I was facing him. "There is one thing, but I don't want you to see me differently, if I tell you." He frowned. "It's something that happened a long time ago, but you told me a thing, so I'm going to do the same." I took a breath and then told him. I told him the story I had only ever told Will, a man who had listened and then released me from the hold it had had over me. I told Sam the story of a girl who 10 years previously had drunk too much and smoked too much, and found to her cost that just because a gang of boys came from good families, it didn't make them good. I told it in a calm voice, a little detached. These days it didn't really feel like it had happened to me after all. Sam listened in the near dark, his eyes on mine, saying nothing. "It's one of the reasons coming to New York and doing this was so important to me. I boxed myself in for years, Sam. I told myself that was what I needed to feel safe. And now? Well, now I guess I need to push myself. I need to know what I'm capable of if I stop looking down." When I had finished, he was silent for a long time. Long enough that I had a momentary doubt as to whether I should have told him at all. But he reached out a hand and stroked my hair. "I'm sorry," he said. "I wish I'd been there to protect you." "I wish." "It's fine," I said. "It was a long time ago." "It's not fine." He pulled me to him. I rested my head against his chest, absorbing the steady beat of his heart. "Just, you know, don't look at me differently," I whispered. "I can't help looking at you differently." I tilted my head so that I could see him. "Only in that I think you're even more amazing," he said, and his arms closed around me. "On top of all the other reasons to love you, you're brave and strong, and you just reminded me. We all have our hurdles. I'll get over mine. But I promise you this, Louisa Clark." His voice, when it came, was low and tender. "Nobody is ever going to hurt you again." Chapter 9. To sillylily@gmail.com. From bumblebeeinny@gmail.com. "Hey, Lily! In haste as I'm tapping this out on the subway. I'm always in haste these days. But lovely to hear from you. Glad school is going so well, though it sounds like you were quite lucky with the smoking thing. Mrs. Trainor is right. It would be a shame if you got expelled before you'd even taken your exams. But I'm not going to lecture you. New York is amazing. I'm enjoying every moment. And yes, it would be lovely if you came out, but I think you'd have to stay in a hotel, so you might want to speak to your parents first. Also, I'm quite busy, as my hours with the Gopniks are long, so I wouldn't have much time to hang out just now. Sam is fine, thanks. Nope, he hasn't dumped me yet. In fact, he's here right now. He heads home later today. You can talk to him about borrowing his motorbike when he's back. I think that may be one for the two of you to sort out between you. Okay, my stop is coming up. Give Mrs. T my love. Tell her I've been doing the things your dad did in his letters. Not all of them. I haven't been on any dates with leggy blonde PR girls. Lou, kiss, kiss, kiss." My alarm went off at 6:30 a.m., a brittle micro-siren breaking the silence. I had to be back at the Gopniks for 7:30. I let out a soft groan as I reached across to the bedside table and fumbled to turn it off. I had figured it would take me 15 minutes to walk back to Central Park. I mentally ran through a rapid to-do list, wondering if there was any shampoo left in the bathroom, and whether I would need to iron my top. Sam's arm reached across and pulled me towards him. "Don't go," he said sleepily. I have to. His arm was pinning me. Be late. He opened one eye. He smelt warm and sweet, and he kept his gaze on mine as he slowly slid a heavy, muscular leg over me. It was impossible to refuse him. Sam was feeling better. Quite a lot better, apparently. I need to get dressed. He was kissing my collarbone, feathery kisses that made me shiver. His mouth, light and focused, began to trace a pattern downwards. He looked up at me from under the cover, one eyebrow raised. I'd forgotten these scars. I really love these scars here. He lowered his head and kissed the silvery ridges on my hip that marked my surgery, making me squirm, then disappeared. Sam, I need to go, really. My fingers closed around the bedspread. Oh. Sometime later, my skin prickling with drying sweat, breathing hard, I lay on my stomach wearing a stupid smile, my muscles aching in unexpected places. My hair was all over my face, but I couldn't summon the energy to push it away. A strand rose and fell with my breath. Sam lay beside me. His hand felt its way across the sheet to mine. I missed you, he said. He shifted and rolled over so that he was on top of me, holding me in place. Louisa Clark, he murmured, and his voice, impossibly deep, resonated somewhere inside me. You do something to me. I think it was you who did something to me, if we're going to get technical about it. His face was filled with tenderness. I lifted my own so that I could kiss him. It was as if the last 48 hours had fallen away. I was in the right place, with the right man, and his arms were around me and his body was beautiful and familiar. I ran a finger down his cheek, then leant in and kissed him slowly. Don't do that again, he said, his eyes on mine. Why? Because then I won't be able to help myself, and you're already late, and I don't want to be responsible for you losing your job. I turned my head to see the alarm. I blinked. 7:45? Are you kidding? How the hell is it 7:45? I wriggled out from under him, my arms flapping, and hopped to the bathroom. Oh, my God, I am so late. Oh, no, 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 no. I threw myself under a shower so rapid it's possible the droplets didn't make contact with my body. And when I emerged, he stood and held out items of clothing for me so that I could slide into them. Shoes! Where are my shoes? He held them up. Hair? He said, gesturing. You need to comb your hair. It's all... well... What? Matted. Sexy. Just had sex hair. I'll pack your things, he said. As I ran for the door, he caught me by the arm and pulled me to him. Or you could, you know, just be a tiny bit later. I am later! So later! It's just once. She's your new best mate. They're hardly going to fire you. He put his arms around me and kissed me, and ran his lips down the side of my neck so that I shivered. And this is my last morning here. Sam! 5 minutes. It's never 5 minutes. Oh, man. I can't believe I'm saying that like it's a bad thing. He growled with frustration. Damn it. I feel okay today. Like, really okay. Believe me, I can tell. Sorry, he said, and then, no, I'm not. Not remotely. I grinned at him, closed my eyes and kissed him back, feeling even then how easy it would be just to topple back onto the burgundy bedspread of doom and lose myself again. Me either. I'll see you later, though. I wriggled out of his arms and ran out of the room and along the corridor, listening to his yelled, I love you! And thinking that despite potential bedbugs, unsanitary bedspreads, and inadequate bathroom soundproofing, actually, this was a very nice hotel indeed. Mr. Gopnik was suffering acute pain in his legs and had been awake half the night, which had left Agnes anxious and fractious. She had had a bad weekend at the country club, the other women freezing her out of conversation and gossiping about her in the spa. From the way Nathan whispered this as I passed him in the lobby, it sounded like 13-year-old girls on a toxic sleepover. You're late, Agnes growled as she returned from her run with George, mopping her face with a towel. In the next room, I could hear Mr. Gopnik's uncharacteristically raised voice on the telephone. She didn't look at me as she spoke. I'm sorry, it's because my... I began, but she had already walked past. She's freaking out about the charity reception this evening, murmured Michael, heading past me with an armful of dry cleaning and a clipboard. I racked my mental Rolodex. Children's Cancer Hospital?
The very one, he said. She's meant to bring a doodle.
A doodle? A little picture on a special card. They auction them off at the dinner. So how hard is that? She can do a smiley face or a flower or something. I'll do it if she likes. I can do a mean smiling horse. I can put a hat on it too, with ears sticking out. I was still full of Sam and found it hard to see the problem in anything. He looked at me.
Sweetheart, you think doodle means actual doodle?
Oh, no. It has to be real art.
I got B in GCSE art.
You're so sweet. No, Louisa, they don't do it themselves. Every artist between here and Brooklyn Bridge has apparently spent the weekend creating some delicious little pen and ink study for cold, hard cash. She only found out last night, overheard two of the witches talking about it, before she left the club, and when she asked them, they told her the truth. So, guess what you're doing today? Have a great morning! He blew me a kiss and hurried out of the door. While Agnes showered and had breakfast, I did an online search of artists in New York. It was about as much use as searching dogs with tails. The few who had websites and bothered to pick up the phone answered my request like I'd suggested they waltz naked around the nearest shopping mall.
You want Mr. Fischel to do a doodle for a charity lunch?
Two put the phone down on me. Artists, it turned out, took themselves very seriously. I called everyone I could find. I called galleries in Chelsea. I called the New York Academy of Art. All the while, I tried not to think about what Sam was doing. He would be having a nice brunch in that diner we'd talked about. He would be walking the High Line like we were meant to. I needed to be back in time to take that ferry ride with him before he left for England. To do it at dusk would be romantic. I pictured us, his arm around me, gazing up at the Statue of Liberty, dropping a kiss on my hair. I dragged my thoughts back and racked my brains. And then I thought about the only other person I knew in New York who might be able to help.
Josh? Speaking.
The sound of a million male voices behind him.
It's Louisa Clark. We met at the Yellow Ball. Louisa, great to hear from you. How are you doing?
He sounded so relaxed, as if strange women called him every day of the week.
They probably did. Hold on, let me take this outside. So what's up?
He had this way of making you feel instantly at ease. I wondered if Americans were born with it.
Actually, I'm in a bit of a bind, and I don't know many people in New York, so I wondered if you might be able to help me. Try me.
I explained the situation, leaving out Agnes's mood, her paranoia, my utter stammering terror faced with the New York art scene.
Shouldn't be too hard. When do you need this thing by?
That's the tricky bit.
Tonight?
A sharp intake of breath.
Okay. Yeah, that's a little tougher.
I ran a hand through my hair.
I know, it's nuts. If I'd known about it sooner, I might have been able to do something. I'm really sorry to have bothered you.
No, no. We'll fix this. Can I call you back? Agnes was out on the balcony smoking. Turns out I wasn't the only person who used the space after all. It was cold and she was swaddled in a huge cashmere wrap, her fingers faintly pink where her hand emerged from the soft wool. I put out a number of calls. I'm just waiting for someone to get back to me.
You know what they will say, Louisa. If I bring them a stupid doodle...
I waited.
They will say I have no culture. What can you expect from stupid Polish masseuse? Or they will say that nobody wanted to do it for me.
It's only 12:20. We've still got time.
I don't know why I bother.
She said softly. Strictly speaking, I wanted to say it wasn't her doing the bothering. Her chief concern right now seemed to be smoking and looking moody. But I knew my place. Just then my phone rang.
Louisa.
Josh.
I think I have someone who can help. Can you get over to East Williamsburg?
20 minutes later, we were in the car headed towards the Midtown Tunnel. As we sat in the traffic, Gary impassive and silent in the front, Agnes called Mr. Gopnik, anxious about his health, his pain.
Is Nathan coming to the office?
Did you have painkillers?
Are you sure you're okay, darling? You don't want me to come bring you anything?
No, I'm in the car.
I have to sort something for this evening.
Yes, I'm still going. It's all fine.
I could just make out his voice at the other end. Low, reassuring. She hung up and gazed out of the window, heaving a long sigh. I waited a moment, then started running through my notes. So, apparently, this Stephen Lipcotz is up and coming in the fine art world. He's had chosen some very important places, and he's... I scanned my notes. Figurative, not abstract. So you just need to tell him what you want him to draw, and he'll do it. I'm not sure how much it will cost, though.
It doesn't matter, said Agnes. It's going to be a disaster.
I turned back to the iPad and did an online search on the artist's name. With relief, I noticed that the drawings were indeed beautiful. Sinuous depictions of the body. I handed the iPad to Agnes so that she could see, and in a moment her mood lifted.
This is good.
She sounded almost surprised.
Yep. If you can think of what you want, we can get him to draw it and be back for 4, maybe?
And then I can leave, I added silently, while she scrolled through the other images I texted Sam. How you doing?
Not bad. Went for a nice walk, bought souvenir beer hat for Jake.
Don't laugh. Wish I was with you. A pause.
So what time do you think you'll get off?
I worked out I should leave for the airport by 7. Hoping 4. We'll stay in touch. Kiss, 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 kiss. New York traffic meant it took us an hour to get to the address Josh had given me. A scruffy, featureless former office building at the back of an industrial block. Gary pulled up with a sceptical sniff.
You sure this is the place?
He said, turning with effort in his seat. I checked the address. That's what it says.
I will stay in car, Louisa. I'm going to call Leonard again.
The upper corridor was lined with doors, a couple of which were open, music blaring. I walked along slowly, checking the numbers. Some had tins of white emulsion paint outside, and I walked past an open door, revealing a woman in baggy jeans, stretching a canvas over a huge wood frame.
Hi, do you know where Stephen is?
She fired a battery of staples from a huge metal gun into a frame.
14. I think he just went out for food.
14 was at the far end. I knocked, then pushed the door tentatively and walked in. The studio was lined with canvases, two huge tables covered with sloppy trays of oil paints and battered pastel crayons. The walls were hung with beautiful, oversized pictures of women in various states of undress, some unfinished. The air smelt of paint, turpentine, and stale cigarette smoke.
Hello?
I turned to see a man holding a white plastic bag. He was around 30, his features regular but his gaze intense, his chin unshaven, his clothes crumpled and utilitarian, as if he had barely noticed what he'd put on. He looked like a male model in a particularly esoteric fashion magazine.
Hi, Louisa Clark. We spoke on the phone earlier. Well, we didn't. Your friend Josh told me to come.
Oh, yeah. You want to buy a drawing?
Not as such. You need to do a drawing. Just a small one.
He sat down on a small stool, opened his carton of noodles and started to eat, hoiking them into his mouth with the rapid strokes of his chopsticks.
It's for a charity thing. People do these... do...
small drawings, I corrected myself. And apparently a lot of the top artists in New York are doing them for other people, so...
Top artists... he repeated.
Well, yes. Apparently it's not the done thing to do your own, and Agnes, my employer, really needs someone brilliant to do one for her. My voice sounded high and anxious.
I mean, it shouldn't take you long. We don't want anything fancy.
He was staring at me, and I heard my voice trail off, thin and uncertain.
We can pay quite well, I added. And it's for charity.
He took another mouthful, peering intently into his carton. I stood by the window and waited.
Yeah, he said when he had finished chewing. I'm not your man.
But Josh said...
You want me to create something to satisfy the ego of some woman who can't draw and doesn't want to be shown up in front of her ladies who lunch?
He shook his head.
You want me to draw you a greetings card?
Mr. Lipcotz, please. I probably haven't explained it very well.
You explained it just fine. But Josh said nothing about greeting cards. I hate that charity dinner shit.
Me also, Agnes said in the doorway. She took a step into the room, glancing down to make sure she was not stepping onto one of the tubes of paint or bits of paper that littered the floor. She held out a long, pale hand. Agnes Gopnik, I hate this charity shit too.
Stephen Lipcott stood slowly, and then almost as if it were an impulse from a more courtly age that he had little control over, raised his hand to shake hers. He couldn't take his eyes from her face. I had forgotten that Agnes got you like that at first meeting.
Mr. Lipcott's, is that right? Lipcott's?
I know this is not a normal thing for you, but I have to go to this thing with room of witches, you know? Actual witches. And I draw like 3-year-old in mittens. If I have to go and show them my drawing, they bitch about me more than they do already.
She sat down and pulled a cigarette from her handbag. She reached across and picked up a lighter that sat on one of his painting tables and lit her cigarette.
Stephen Lipcott's was still watching her, his chopsticks loose in his hand.
I am not from this place. I am Polish masseuse. There is no shame in this. But I do not want to give these witches chance to look down on me again. Do you know how it is to have people look down on you?
She exhaled, gazing at him, her head tilted, so that smoke trickled horizontally towards him. I thought he might actually have inhaled.
Yeah.
So it is one small thing I am asking you. To help me. I know this is not your thing and that you are a serious artist, but I really need help, and I will pay you very good money.
The room fell silent. A phone vibrated in my back pocket. I tried to ignore it. For that moment I knew I should not move. We three stood there for an eternity.
Okay, he said finally, but on one condition.
Name it.
I draw you.
For a minute nobody spoke. Agnes raised an eyebrow and then took a slow drag of her cigarette, her eyes not leaving his.
Me? Can't be the first time someone's asked.
Why me?
Don't play the ingenue.
He smiled then, and she kept her face straight, as if deciding whether to be insulted. Her eyes dropped to her feet, and when she lifted them, there it was. Her smile. Small, speculative, a prize he believed he had won. She stubbed out her cigarette on the floor.
How long will it take?
He shoved the carton of noodles to one side and reached for a white pad of thick paper. It might have been only me who noticed the way his voice lowered in volume.
Depends how good you are at keeping still.
Minutes later, I was back in the car. I closed the door. Gary was listening to his tapes.
Por favor, habla más despacio.
Por favor, habla más despacio.
He slapped the dashboard with a fat palm.
Ah, crap. Let me try that again. Habla más despacio.
He practiced 3 more lines, then turned to me.
She gonna be long.
I stared out of the window at the blank windows of the second floor. I really hope not, I said. Agnes finally emerged at 4:15, an hour and 3/4 after Gary and I had run out of our already limited conversation. After watching a cable comedy show downloaded on his iPad, he didn't offer to share it with me, he had nodded off, his chins resting on the bulk of his chest as he snored lightly. I sat in the back of the car, growing increasingly tense as the minutes ticked by, sending periodic messages to Sam that were variations on, "She's not back yet." Still not back.
Oh my God, what on earth is she doing in there?
He had had lunch in a tiny deli across town and said he was so hungry he could eat 15 horses. He sounded cheerful, relaxed, and every word we exchanged told me I was in the wrong place, that I should be beside him, leaning against him, feeling his voice rumble in my ear. I had started to hate Agnes. And suddenly there she was, striding out of the building with a broad smile and a flat package under her arm.
Oh, thank God, I said.
Gary woke with a start and hurried around the car to open the door for her. She slid in calmly, as if she had been gone 2 minutes instead of 2 hours. She brought with her the faint scents of cigarettes and turpentine.
"We need to stop at McNally Jackson on the way back to get some pretty paper to wrap it in."
"We have wrapping paper at the..."
"Stephen told me about this special hand-pressed paper. I want to wrap it in this special paper. Gary, you know the place I mean? We can drop down to Soho on the way back, yes?"
She waved a hand. I sat back, faintly despairing. Gary set off, bumping the limo gently over the potholed car park as he headed back to what he considered civilization. We arrived back at Fifth Avenue at 4:40. As Agnes climbed out, I hurried out beside her, clutching the bag with the special paper. "Agnes, I was wondering what you said about me leaving early today."
"I don't know whether to wear the Temperley or the Badgley Mishka this evening. What do you think?"
I tried to recall either dress. Failed. I was trying to calculate how long it would take me to get over to Times Square, where Sam was now waiting. "The Temperley, I think, definitely. It's perfect. Agnes, you remember you said I might be able to leave early today?
But it's such a dark blue. I'm not sure this blue is a good colour on me. And the shoes that go with it rub on my heel."
"We talked last week. Would it be okay? It's just I really want to see Sam off at the airport." I fought to keep the irritation from my voice.
"Sam," she nodded a greeting at a shook.
"My boyfriend." She considered this.
Okay. Oh, they are going to be so impressed with this drawing. Stephen is a genius, you know? Actual genius."
"So I can go?"
"Sure."
My shoulders sagged with relief. If I left in 10 minutes, I could get the subway south and be with him by 5:30. That would still give us an hour and a bit together. Better than nothing. The lift doors closed behind us. Agnes opened a compact and checked her lipstick, pouting at her reflection.
"But maybe just stay until I'm dressed. I need a second opinion on this temporarily."
Agnes changed her outfit 4 times. I was too late to meet Sam in Midtown, Times Square, or anywhere else. Instead, I got to JFK 15 minutes before he had to head through security. I shoved my way past the other passengers to where I could see him standing in front of the departures board, and hurled myself through the airport doors and against his back. "I'm sorry, I'm so, so sorry." We held each other for a minute.
"What happened?"
"Agnes happened."
"Wasn't she going to let you out early? Thought she was your mate."
"She was just obsessed by this artwork thing, and it all went... Oh, God, it was maddening!" I threw my hands into the air. "What am I even doing in this stupid job, Sam? She made me wait because she couldn't work out what dress to wear. At least Will actually needed me." He tilted his head and touched his forehead to mine. "We have this morning." I kissed him, reaching around his neck so that I could place my whole self against him. We stayed there, eyes closed, as the airport moved and swayed around us. And then my phone rang. "I'm ignoring it," I said into his chest. It continued to ring, insistently.
"It might be her."
He held me gently away from him. I let out a low growl, then pulled my phone from my back pocket and put it to my ear. "Agnes?" I struggled to keep the irritation from my voice.
"It's Josh. I was just calling to see how today went."
"Josh? Oh, yes, it was fine. Thank you." I turned away slightly, putting my hand up to my other ear. I felt Sam stiffen beside me.
"So, he did the drawing for you?"
"He did. She's really happy. Thank you so much for organising it. Listen, I'm in the middle of something right now, but thank you. It really was incredibly kind of you.
Glad it worked out.
Listen, give me a call, yeah? Let's grab a coffee sometime."
"Sure."
I ended the call to find Sam watching me.
"Josh," he said.
I put the phone back into my pocket.
"The guy you met at the ball?"
"It's a long story."
"Okay."
"He helped me sort this drawing for Agnes today. I was desperate."
"So you had his number?"
"It's New York. Everyone has everyone's number." He dragged his hand over the top of his head and turned away. "It's nothing, really." I took a step towards him, pulled him by his belt buckle. I could feel the weekend sliding away from me again. Sam? Sam? He deflated, put his arms around me. He rested his chin on the top of my head and moved his from side to side. This is... I know, I said. I know it is. But I love you, and you love me, and at least we managed to do a bit of the getting naked thing. And it was great, wasn't it? The getting naked thing?
For like 5 minutes.
Best 5 minutes of the last 4 weeks. 5 minutes that will keep me going for the next four.
Except it's seven.
I slid my hand into his back pockets. Don't let's end this badly. Please. I don't want you to go away angry because of some stupid call from someone who is literally nothing to me. His face softened when he held my gaze, as it always did. It was one of the things I loved about him, the way his features, so brutal in repose, melted when he looked at me.
I'm not pissed off at you. I'm pissed off at myself, and airline food, or burritos, or whatever it was. And your woman there who can't apparently put on a dress by herself.
I'll be back for Christmas.
For a whole week.
Sam frowned. He took my face in his hands. They were warm and slightly rough. We stood there for a moment, and then we kissed. And some decades later he straightened up and glanced at the board.
And now you have to go.
And now I have to go. I swallowed the lump that had risen in my throat. He kissed me once more, then swung his bag over his shoulder. I stood on the concourse, watching the space where he had been for a full minute after security had swallowed him.
In general, I'm not a moody person. I'm not very good at the whole door-slamming, scowling, eye-rolling thing. But that evening, I made my way back to the city, pushed my way through the crowds on the subway platform, elbows out and scowled like a native. Throughout the journey, I found myself checking the time. He's in the departure lounge. He'll be boarding. And he's gone. The moment his plane was due to take off, I felt something sink inside me, and my mood darkened even further. I picked out some takeout sushi and walked from the subway station to the Gopnik's building. When I got to my little room, I sat and stared at the container, then at the wall. I knew I couldn't stay there alone with my thoughts, so I knocked on Nathan's door.
Come in!
Nathan was watching American football, holding a beer. He was wearing a pair of surfer shorts and a T-shirt. He looked up at me expectantly, and with the faintest of delays, in the way people do when they're letting you know that they're really locked into something else.
Can I eat my dinner in here with you?
He tore his gaze away from the screen again.
Bad day?
I nodded.
Need a hug?
I shook my head. Just a virtual one. If you're nice to me, I'll probably cry.
Aw, your man gone home, has he?
It was a disaster, Nathan. He was sick for pretty much the whole thing, and then Agnes wouldn't let me have the time off she'd promised me today, so I barely got to see him, and when I did, it kept getting awkward between us. Nathan turned down the television with a sigh and patted the side of the bed. I climbed up and placed my takeout bag on my lap, where later I would discover soy sauce had leaked through onto my work trousers. I rested my head on his shoulder. Long-distance relationships are tough, Nathan pronounced, as if he was the first person to have considered such a thing. Then he added,
like, really tough.
Right.
It's not just the sex and the inevitable jealousy.
We're not jealous people.
But he's not going to be the first person you tell stuff to. The day-to-day bits and pieces. And that stuff is important.
He proffered his beer and I took a swig, handing it back to him. We did know it was going to be hard. I mean, we talked about all this before I left. But you know what's really bugging me? He dragged his gaze back from the screen.
Go on.
Agnes knew how much I wanted to spend time with Sam. We talked about it. She was the one saying we had to be together, that we shouldn't be apart, blah, blah, blah. And then she made me stay with her until the absolute last minute.
That's the job, Lou. They come first.
But she knew how important it was to me.
Maybe.
She's meant to be my friend. Nathan raised an eyebrow.
Lou, the trainers were not normal employers. Will was not a normal employer. Neither are the Gopniks. These people may act nice, but ultimately, you have to remember this is a power relationship.
It's a business transaction. He took a swig of his beer. You know what happened to the Gopnik's last social secretary? Agnes told old man Gopnik that she was talking about her behind her back, spreading secrets. So they sacked her. After 22 years, they sacked her.
And was she?
Was she what? Spreading secrets? I don't know. Not the point, though, is it? I didn't want to contradict him, but to explain why Agnes and I were different would have been betraying her. So I said nothing. Nathan seemed about to say something, then changed his mind.
What?
Look, nobody can have everything.
What do you mean?
This is a really great job, right? I mean, you might not think that tonight, but you've got a great situation in the heart of New York. A good wage and a decent employer. You get to go to all sorts of great places and some occasional perks. They bought you a nearly $3,000 ball dress, right? I got to go to the Bahamas with Mr. G a couple of months ago. 5-star hotel, beachfront room, the lot. Just for a couple of hours work a day. So we're lucky. But in the long term, the cost of all that might turn out to be a relationship with someone whose life is completely different and a million miles away. That's the choice you make when you head out.
I stared at him.
I just think you've got to be realistic about these things. You're not really helping, Nathan. I'm being straight with you. And hey, look on the bright side. I heard you did a great job today with the drawing. Mr. G told me he was really impressed.
They really liked it.
I tried to suppress my glow of pleasure. Aw, man, seriously, they loved it. She's going to knock those charity ladies dead.
I leant against him, and he switched the volume back up.
Thanks, Nathan, I said, and opened my sushi.
You're a mate.
He grimaced slightly. Yeah, that whole fishy thing. Any chance you could wait until you're in your own room?
I closed my sushi box.
He was right. Nobody could have everything.
Chapter 10. To Mr. and Mrs. Bernard Clark at yahoo.com. From bumblebeeinny@gmail.com.
Hey, Mum. Sorry for the late reply. It's quite busy here. Never a dull moment. I'm glad you like the pictures.
Yes, the carpets are 100% wool. Some of the rugs are silk. The wood is definitely not veneer. And I asked Ilaria, and they get their curtains dry cleaned once a year while they spend a month in the Hamptons. The cleaners are very thorough, but Ilaria does the kitchen floor every day herself because she doesn't trust them.
Yes, Mrs. Gopnik does have a walk-in shower and also a walk-in wardrobe in her dressing room. She's very fond of her dressing room and spends a lot of time in there on the phone to her mum in Poland.
I didn't have time to count the shoes like you asked, but I'd say there are well over 100 pairs. She has them stacked in boxes with pictures of them stuck to the front just so she knows which is which. When she gets a new pair, it's my job to take the picture. She has a camera just for this.
I'm glad the art course went well and the better communication for couples class sounds grand. But you must tell Dad that it's not to do with bedroom stuff. He sent me 3 emails this week asking if I think he could fake a heart murmur.
Sorry to hear that Grandad's been under the weather. Is he still hiding his vegetables under the table?
Are you sure you have to give up your night classes?
Seems like a shame.
Okay, gotta go. Agnes is calling me. I'll let you know about Christmas, but don't worry. I will be there.
Love you,
Louisa.
Kiss, kiss, kiss.
P.S. No, I haven't seen Robert De Niro again. But yes, if I do, I will definitely tell him that you liked him very much in The Mission.
P.P.S.
No, I honestly haven't spent any time in Angola, and I'm not in urgent need of a cash transfer. Don't answer those ones.
I'm no expert on depression. I haven't even understood my own after Will died. But I found Agnes's moods especially hard to fathom. My mother's friends who suffered with depression, and there seemed to be a dismaying number of them, seemed flattened by life, struggling through a fog that descended until they could see no joy, no prospect of pleasure. It obscured their way forward. You could see it in the way they walked around town, their shoulders bowed, their mouths set in thin lines of forbearance. It was as if sadness seeped from them. Agnes was different. She was boisterous and garrulous one minute, then weepy and furious the next. I'd been told that she felt isolated, judged without allies. But that never quite fitted.
because the more time I spent with her, the more I noticed that she was not really cowed by those women. She was infuriated by them. She would rage about the unfairness, scream at Mr. Gopnik. She would imitate them cruelly behind his back, and mutter furiously about the first Mrs. Gopnik or Ilaria in her scheming ways. She was mercurial, a human flame of outrage, growling about Sipa or Debil or Chivka. I would Google these in my time off until my ears went pink. And then, abruptly, she was someone quite different. A woman who disappeared into rooms and wept quietly. A tense, frozen face after a long phone call in Polish. Her sadness manifested itself in headaches, which I was never quite sure were real. I talked about it to Trina, in the coffee shop with the free Wi-Fi that I had sat in on my first morning in New York. We were using FaceTime audio, which I preferred to us looking at each other's faces as we talked. I got distracted by the way my nose appeared enormous, or what someone was doing behind me. I also didn't want her to see the size of the buttered muffins I was eating. "Perhaps she's bipolar," Trina said. "Yeah, I looked that up, but it doesn't seem to fit. She's never manic, as such. Just sort of energetic." "I'm not sure depression is a one-size-fits-all thing, Lou," my sister said. "Besides, hasn't everyone got something wrong with them in America? Don't they like to take a lot of pills? Unlike England, where Mum would have you go for a nice brisk walk." "To take you out of yourself," my sister sniggered. "Turn that frown upside down. Put a nice bit of lippy on, brighten your face up. There, who needs all those silly medications?" Something had happened to Trina's and my relationship since I had been gone. We called each other once a week, and for the first time in our adult lives, she had stopped nagging me every time we spoke. She seemed genuinely interested in what my life was like, quizzing me about work, the places I had visited, and what the people around me did all day. When I asked for advice, she generally gave me a considered reply instead of calling me a doofus or asking me if I understood what Google was for. She liked someone. She had confided 2 weeks previously. They had gone for hipster cocktails at a bar in Shoreditch, then to a pop-up cinema in Clapton, and she had felt quite giddy for several days afterwards. The idea of my sister giddy was a novel one. "What's he like? You must be able to tell me something now." "I'm not going to say anything yet. Every time I talk about these things, they go wrong. Not even to me. For now. It's, well, anyway, I'm happy." "Oh, so that's why you're being nice." "What? You're getting some. I thought it was because you finally approved of what I'm doing with my life." She laughed. My sister didn't normally laugh unless it was at me. "I just think it's nice that everything's working out. You have a great job in the US of A. I love my job. Tom and I are loving being in the city. I feel like things are really opening up for all of us." It was such an unlikely statement for my sister to make that I didn't have the heart to tell her about Sam. We talked a bit more about Mum wanting to take a part-time job at the local school and Grandad's deteriorating health, which meant that she hadn't applied. I finished my muffin and my coffee and realised that while I was interested, I didn't feel homesick at all. "You're not going to start speaking with that bloody awful transatlantic accent, though, right?"
"And me, Treen. That's hardly going to change,"
I said, in a bloody awful transatlantic accent.
"You're such a doofus," she said.
"Oh, goodness, you're still here."
Mrs. DeWitt was just exiting the building as I arrived home, pulling on her gloves under the awning. I stepped back, neatly avoiding Dean Martin's teeth snapping near my leg, and smiled politely at her. "Good morning, Mrs. DeWitt. Where else would I be?"
"I thought the Estonian lap dancer would have sacked you by now. I'm surprised she's not frightened you'll run off with the old man like she did."
"Not really my modus operandi, Mrs. DeWitt," I said cheerfully.
"I heard her yelling again in the corridor the other night. Awful racket. At least the other one just sulked for a couple of decades. A lot easier on neighbors."
"I'll pass that on." She shook her head and was about to move away, but she stopped and gazed at my outfit. I was wearing a fine pleated gold skirt, my fake fur gilet, and a beanie hat coloured like a giant strawberry that Tom had been given for Christmas 2 years ago and refused to wear because it was girly. On my feet were a pair of bright red patent brogues that that I had brought from a sale in a children's shoe shop, air-punching amid the harassed mothers and screeching toddlers, when I realized they fitted.
Your skirt.
I glanced down and braced myself for whatever barb was coming my way.
I used to have one like that, from Bieber.
It is Bieber, I said delightedly. I got it from an online auction 2 years ago. £4.50. Only one tiny hole in the waistband.
I have that exact skirt. I used to travel a lot in the 60s. Whenever I went to London, I would spend hours in that store. I used to ship whole trunks of Bieber dresses back home to Manhattan. We had nothing like it here.
Sounds like heaven. I've seen pictures, I said.
What an amazing thing to have been able to do. What did you do? I mean, why did you travel so much? I worked in fashion for a woman's magazine. It was...
She lurched forward, ambushed by a fit of coughing, and I waited while she recovered her breath.
Well, anyway, you look quite reasonable, she said, putting her hand up against the wall.
Then she turned and hobbled away up the street, Dean Martin casting baleful glances simultaneously at me and the curb behind him. The rest of the week was, as Michael would say,
interesting.
Tabitha's apartment in Soho was being redecorated, and our apartment, for a week or so, became the battleground for a series of turf wars, apparently invisible to the male gaze, but only too obvious to Agnes, whom I could hear hissing at Mr. Gopnik when she thought Tabitha was out of range. Ilaria relished her role as foot soldier. She made a point of serving Tab's favourite dishes, spicy curries and red meat, none of which Agnes would eat, and professed herself ignorant of that when Agnes complained. She made sure Tab's laundry was done first and left folded neatly on her bed, while Agnes raced through the apartment in a toweling robe trying to work out what had happened to the blouse she had planned to wear that day. In the evenings, Tab would plant herself in the sitting room, while Agnes was on the phone to her mother in Poland. She would hum, noisily scrolling through her iPad, until Agnes, silently enraged, would get up and decamp to her dressing room. Occasionally, Tab invited girlfriends to the apartment, and they took over the kitchen or the television room, a gaggle of noisy voices, gossiping, giggling, a ring of blonde heads that fell silent if Agnes happened to walk past.
"It's her house too, my darling," Mr. Gopnik would say mildly when Agnes protested. "She did grow up here."
"She treats me like I am temporary fixture."
"She'll get used to you in time. She's still a child in many ways."
"She's 24! Agnes would make a low, growling noise, a sound I was quite sure no Englishwoman had ever mastered. I did try a few times, and throw up her hands in exasperation. Michael would walk past me, his face frozen, his eyes sliding towards mine in mute solidarity. Agnes asked me to send a parcel to Poland via FedEx. She wanted me to pay cash and keep hold of the receipt. The box was large, square, and not particularly heavy, and we had the conversation in her study, which she had taken to locking to Ilaria's disgust.
"What is it?"
"Just a present for my mother," she waved a hand.
"But Leonard thinks I spend too much on my family, so I don't want him to know everything that I send."
I humped it down to the FedEx office at West 57th Street and waited in line. When I filled out the form with the assistant, he asked,
"What are the contents? For customs purposes."
And I realized I didn't know. I texted Agnes, and she responded swiftly, "Just say it's gifts for family."
"But what kind of gifts, ma'am?" said the man wearily.
I texted again. There was an audible sigh from someone in the queue behind me.
"Tchotchkes."
I stared at the message. Then I held out my phone. "Sorry, I can't pronounce that." He peered at it.
"Yeah, lady, that's not really helping me."
I texted Agnes. "Tell him mind his own business. What business of him would I send to my mother?" I shoved my phone into my pocket. "She says it's cosmetics, a jumper, and a couple of DVDs."
"Value?"
$185.52.
"Finally,"
muttered the FedEx employee, and I handed over the house credit card and hoped nobody else could see the crossed fingers on my other hand. On Friday afternoon, when Agnes began her piano lesson, I retreated to my room and called England. As I dialed Sam's number, I felt the familiar flutter of excitement just at the prospect of hearing his voice. Some days I missed him so much I carried it round like an ache.
I sat and waited as it rang. And a woman answered.
"Hello,"
she said. She was well-spoken, her voice slightly raspy at the edges, as if she had smoked too many cigarettes. "Oh, I'm sorry, I must have dialed the wrong number." I briefly pulled the phone away from my ear and stared at the screen.
"Who are you after?"
"Sam? Sam Fielding? He's in the shower. Hold on, I'll get him." Her hand went over the receiver and she yelled his name, her voice briefly muffled. I went very still. There were no young women in Sam's family.
"He's just coming," she said after a moment. "Who shall I say is calling?"
"Louisa."
"Oh, okay."
Long-distance phone calls make you oddly attuned to slight variations in tone and emphasis, and there was something in that "oh" made me uneasy. I was about to ask whom I was talking to when Sam picked up.
"Hey!
Hey!" It came out strangely broken, as my mouth had dried unexpectedly and I had to say it twice.
"What's up?"
"Nothing. I mean, nothing urgent. I just, you know, wanted to hear your voice."
"Hold on, I'll close this door."
I could picture him, in the little railway carriage, pulling the bedroom door to. When he came back on, he sounded cheery, quite unlike the last time we had spoken.
"So, what's going on? Everything okay with you? What's the time there?"
"Just after 2. Who was that?"
"Oh, that's Katie."
"Katie?"
"Katie Ingram, my new partner."
"Katie! Okay! So, what's she doing in your house?"
"Oh, she's just giving me a lift to Donna's leaving do. Bike's gone into the garage. Problem with the exhaust."
"She really is looking after you, then?" I wondered absently if he was wearing a towel.
"Yeah, she only lives down the road, so it made sense."
He said it with the casual neutrality of someone aware he was being listened to by 2 women. "So, where are you all off to?"
"That tapas place in Hackney, the one that used to be a church. I'm not sure we ever went there."
"A church? So you'll have to be on your best behaviour." I laughed, too loudly.
"Bunch of paramedics on a night out. I doubt it."
There was a short silence. I tried to ignore the knot in my stomach. Sam's voice softened.
"You sure you're okay? You sound a little..."
"I'm fine! Totally! Like I said, I just wanted to hear your voice."
"Sweetheart, it's great to speak to you, but I have to go. Katie did me a big favour giving me a lift, and we're late already."
"Okay, well, have a lovely evening. Don't do anything I wouldn't." I was talking in exclamation marks. "And give Donna my best."
"Will do. We'll speak later in the week."
"Love you." It sounded more plaintive than I'd intended. "Write to me."
"Oh, Lou," he said.
And then he was gone. And I was left staring at my phone in an all-too-silent room. I organised a private view of a new film at a small screening room for the wives of Mr. Gopnik's business associates, and the hors d'oeuvres that would go with it. I disputed a bill for flowers that had not been received, and then I ran down to Sephora and picked up 2 bottles of nail varnish that Agnes had seen in Vogue and wanted to take with her to the country. And 2 minutes after my shift finished and the Gopniks departed for their weekend retreat, I said no thank you to Ilaria's offer of leftover meatballs and ran back to my room. Listener, I did the stupid thing. I looked her up on Facebook. It didn't take more than 40 minutes to filter this Katie Ingram from the other 100 or so. Her profile was unlocked and contained the logo for the NHS. Her job description said, "Paramedic, love my job!" She had hair that could have been red or strawberry blonde, it was hard to tell from the photographs, and she was possibly in her late 20s, pretty with a snub nose. In the first 30 photographs she had posted, she was laughing with friends, frozen in the middle of good times. She looked annoyingly good in a bikini. "Skiathos, 2014! What a laugh!" She had a small hairy dog, a penchant for vertiginously high heels, and a best friend with long dark hair who was fond of kissing her cheek in pictures. I briefly entertained the hope that she was gay, but she belonged to a Facebook group called "Hands Up If You're Secretly Delighted That Brad Pitt Is Single Again." Her relationship status was set to single. I scrolled back through her feed, secretly hating myself for doing so, but unable to stop myself. I scanned her photographs, trying to find one where she looked fat or sulky or perhaps the recipient of some terrible scaly skin disease. I clicked and I clicked.
and just as I was about to close my laptop, I stopped. There it was. Posted 3 weeks previously, Katie Ingram stood on a bright winter's day in her dark green uniform, her pack proudly at her feet, outside the ambulance station in East London. This time her arm was around Sam, who stood in his uniform, arms folded, smiling at the camera. "Best partner in the world," read the caption. "Loving my new job." Just below it, her dark-haired friend had commented, "I wonder why," and added a winky face. Here's the thing about jealousy. It's not a good look, and the rational part of you knows that. You are not the jealous sort. That sort of woman is awful. And it makes no sense. If someone likes you, they will stay with you. If they don't like you enough to stay with you, they aren't worth being with anyway. You know that. You are a sensible, mature woman of 28 years. You have read the self-help articles. You have watched Dr. Phil. But when you live 3,500 miles from your handsome, kind, sexy paramedic boyfriend, and he has a new partner who sounds and looks like pussy galore, a woman who spends at least 12 hours a day in close proximity to the man you love, a man who has confessed already to how hard he is finding the physical separation, then the rational part of you gets firmly squashed by the gigantic, squatting toad that is your irrational self. It didn't matter what I did. I couldn't scrub that image of the two of them from my mind. It lodged itself, a white-on-black negative, somewhere behind my eyes and haunted me. Her lightly tanned arm tight around his waist, her fingers resting lightly on the waistband of his uniform. Were they side by side at a late bar, her nudging him at some shared joke? Was she the kind of touchy-feely woman who would reach over and pat his arm for emphasis? Did she smell good, so that when he left her each day he would feel, in some indefinable way, he was missing something? I know this was the way to madness, yet I couldn't stop myself. I thought about calling him, but nothing says stalky, insecure girlfriend like someone who calls you at 4 a.m. My thoughts whirred and tumbled and fell in a great toxic cloud, and I hated myself for them. And they whirred and fell some more. "Oh, why couldn't you just have been partnered with a nice fat man?" I murmured to the ceiling. And sometime in the small hours, I finally fell asleep. On Monday, we ran. I stopped only once, then went shopping in Macy's and bought a bunch of children's clothes for Agnes's niece. I sent them off to Krakow from the FedEx office, this time confident of the contents. Over lunch, she spoke to me about her sister, how she had been married too young to the manager of a local brewery, who treated her with little respect, and how she now felt so downtrodden and worthless that Agnes could not persuade her to leave. "She cries to my mother every day because of what he says to her. She's fat, or she's ugly, or he could have done better. That stinking dickhead piece of chicken shit. A dog would not piss on his leg if it had drunk 100 buckets of water." Her ultimate aim, she confided over her chard and beetroot salad, was to bring her sister to New York, away from that man. "I think I can get Leonard to give her a job, maybe as secretary in his office, or better, housekeeper in our apartment. Then we could get rid of Ilaria. My sister is very good, you know, very conscientious. But she doesn't want to leave Krakow. Maybe she doesn't want to disrupt her daughter's education. My sister was very nervous about moving Tom to London," I said. "Hmm," said Agnes, but I could tell she didn't really think that was an obstacle. I wondered if rich people just didn't see obstacles to anything. We had barely been back half an hour before she glanced at her phone and announced that we were going to East Williamsburg. "The artist? But I thought, Stephen is teaching me to draw. Drawing lessons." I blinked. "Okay. A surprise for Leonard, so you must not say anything." She didn't look at me for the whole journey. "You're late," said Nathan when I arrived home. He was heading off to play basketball with some friends from his gym, his kit bag slung over his shoulder and a hoodie over his hair. "Yeah," I dropped my bag and filled the kettle. I had a carton of noodles in a plastic bag and put them on the counter. "Been anywhere nice?" I hesitated. "Just here and there. You know what she's like." I switched on the kettle. "You okay?" "I'm fine." I could feel his gaze on me until I turned and forced a smile. Then he clapped me on the back and turned to head out.
Some days, eh?
Some days indeed. I stared at the kitchen worktop. I didn't know what to say to him. I didn't know how to explain the 2.5 hours Gary and I had waited in the car for her, my eyes flicking repeatedly up to the light at the obscured window and back to my phone. After an hour, Gary, bored of his language tapes, had texted Agnes to say he was being moved on by a parking attendant, and she should text him as soon as she needed to go. But she didn't respond. We drove around the block and he filled the car with fuel, then suggested we get a coffee.
She didn't say how long she'd be. That usually means she'll be a couple hours at least.
This has happened before.
Mrs. G does as she pleases.
He bought me a coffee in a near-empty diner, where the laminated menu showed poorly lit photographs of every single dish, and we sat in near silence, each monitoring our phones in case she called, and watching the Williamsburg dusk turn gradually to a neon-lit night. I had moved to the most exciting city on earth, yet some days I felt my life had shrunk, limo to apartment, apartment back to limo.
"So have you worked for the Gopniks for long?"
Gary slowly stirred 2 sugars into his coffee, screwing up the wrappers in a fat fist.
"Year and a half."
"Who did you work for before?"
"Someone else."
I took a sip of my coffee, which was surprisingly good.
"You never mind it?"
He looked up at me from under heavy brows.
"All the hanging around," I clarified.
"I mean, does she do this often?"
He kept stirring his coffee, his eyes back on his mug.
"Kid," he said after a minute,
"I don't mean to be rude, but I can see you ain't been in this business long, and you'll last a whole lot longer if you don't ask questions."
He sat back in his chair, his bulk spreading gently across his lap.
"I'm the driver. I'm there when they need me. I speak when I'm spoken to. I see nothing, I hear nothing, forget everything. That's why I've stayed in this game 32 years, and how I've put my 2 ungrateful kids through college. In 2.5 years, I take early retirement and move to my beach property in Costa Rica. That's how you do it."
He wiped his nose with a paper napkin, making his jowls judder.
"You get me?
See nothing, hear nothing,
forget everything. You got it? You want a donut? They do good donuts here. Make them fresh throughout the day."
He got up and moved heavily over to the counter. When he came back, he said nothing more to me, just nodded, satisfied, when I told him that, yes, the donuts were very good indeed. Agnes said nothing when she rejoined us. After a few minutes, she said,
"Did Leonard call? I accidentally turned my phone off."
"No.
He must be at the office. I will call him."
She straightened her hair, then settled back in her seat.
"That was a very good lesson. I really feel like I'm learning many things. Stephen is a very good artist," she announced.
It took me until we were halfway home to notice she wasn't carrying any drawings. Chapter 11. Dear Tom, I'm sending you a baseball cap because Nathan and I went to a real-life baseball game yesterday, and all the players wore them. Actually, they wore helmets, but this is the traditional version. I got one for you and one for someone else I know. Get your mum to take a picture of you in it and I could put it on my wall. No, I'm afraid there aren't any cowboys in this part of America, sadly, but today I am going to a country club, so I will keep an eye out in case one rides by. Thank you for the very nice picture of my bum-bum with my imaginary dog. I hadn't realised my backside was that shade of purple underneath my trousers, but I shall bear that in mind if I ever decide to walk naked past the Statue of Liberty, like in your picture. I think your version of New York may be even more exciting than the real thing. Lots of love, Auntie Lou. Kiss, kiss, kiss. Grand Pines Country Club sprawled across acres of lush countryside, its trees and fields rolling so perfectly and in such a vivid shade of green, they might have sprung from the imagination of a 7-year-old with crayons. On a crisp, clear afternoon, Gary drove us slowly up the long drive, and when the car pulled up in front of the sprawling white building, a young man in a pale blue uniform stepped forward and opened Agnes's door.
"Good morning, Mrs. Gopnik. How are you today?"
"Very good, thank you, Randy. And how are you?"
"Couldn't be better, ma'am. Getting busy in there already. Big day!"
He took the keys, tipped his hat, and drove the car away. Mr. Gopnik having been detained at work, it had fallen to Agnes to present Mary,
one of the long-serving staff at his country club, with a retirement gift. Agnes had made her feelings clear for much of the week about having to do this. She hated the country club. The former Mrs. Klopnik's cronies would be there, and Agnes hated speaking in public. She could not do it without Leonard. But, for once, he was immovable. "It will help you claim your place, darling. And Louisa will be with you." We practiced her speech and we made a plan. We would arrive in the great room as late as possible, at the last moment before the starters were served, so that we could sit down with apologies, blaming Manhattan traffic. Mary Lander, the retiree in question, would stand after the coffee at 2 p.m, and a few people would say nice words about her. Then Agnes would stand, apologize for Mr. Gopnik's unavoidable absence, and say a few more nice words about Mary, before handing over her retirement gift. We would wait a diplomatic half-hour longer, then leave, pleading important business in the city. "You think this dress is okay?" she said, wearing an unusually conservative two-piece, a shift dress in fuchsia with a paler short-sleeved jacket and a string of pearls. Not her usual look, but I understood that she needed to feel as if she was wearing armour. "Perfect." She took a breath and I nudged her, smiling. She took my hand briefly and squeezed it. "In and out," I said. "Nothing to it." "Two giant fingers," she murmured, and gave me a small smile. The building itself was sprawling and light, painted magnolia, with huge vases of flowers and reproduction antique furniture everywhere. Its oak-panelled halls, its portraits of founders on the walls and silent staff, moving from room to room, were accompanied by the gentle hush of quiet conversation, the occasional clink of a coffee cup or glass. Every view was beautiful, every need seemingly already met. The great room was full, 60 or so round, elegantly decorated tables, filled with well-dressed women, chatting over glasses of still mineral water or fruit punch. Hair was uniformly perfectly blow-dried, and the preferred mode of dress was expensively elegant, well-cut dresses with boucle jackets, or carefully matched separates. The air was thick with a heady mix of perfume. At some tables, a solitary man sat flanked by women, but they seemed oddly neutered in such a largely female room. To the casual observer, or perhaps an average man, almost nothing would have seemed amiss. A faint movement of heads, a subtle dip in the noise levels as we passed, the slight pursing of lips. I walked behind Agnes, and she faltered suddenly, so that I almost collided with her back. And then I saw the table setting. Tabitha, a young man, an older man, two women I did not recognize, and beside me, an older woman who lifted her head and looked Agnes square in the eye. As the waiter stepped forward and pulled out her seat, Agnes was seated opposite the Big Purple herself, Catherine Gopnik. "Good afternoon," Agnes said, offering it up to the table as a whole and managing not to look at the first Mrs. Gopnik as